Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here talking about the different types of forests that we find here in our state with our first guest, John Kotar. John is a retired forest ecologist from the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at UW-Madison. He was involved in preparing several guidebooks that help foresters in habitat-type forest communities. So talk about the different forest communities we have, what it means to, what they mean to you. John Kotar, welcome. Great to have you with us.
Great to be here, Larry.
Listen, that we have the different types of forest in Wisconsin are classified or differentiated, I guess, according to the, what's it called, the Forest Habitat Type Classification System.
Yeah, the system that we're talking about today, it's a sort of a new idea, a new approach to forests. The forests have traditionally been classified simply by, foresters call it cover type. In other words, the dominant vegetation, the dominant trees that you see in a forest. Most of our forests are mixed one way or another.
Yeah.
But one type or another predominates. So in general, that has been the case. But that is not enough by any means.
Yeah.
Because different mixtures of trees can occur for different reasons at different times. Disturbance, human and otherwise, is a factor and so forth. So what we really need to know is what is the fundamental basis that make the, that leads to the development of a natural forest. Even our natural forests, as we look at them across the state, they differ tremendously, and they're primarily driven by, obviously, climate. North, it's a bit different. South. Soils are the main thing. And we have hundreds and hundreds of kinds of soils, if you were to describe them in a scientific way. And here, to get into that, I always relate my my subject to people who like to garden or farm because they understand the differences in soil. A little too sandy over here, some plants won't grow. A little too clay, too wet over there, something else won't grow. So that's one thing. But in a farming and gardening communities, we kind of quickly adjust. We find which plants we're going to cultivate that way, and we kind of get going. Forests are different. The forests are developing on their own, and they are simply driven by what is underneath. And we need to know what that is.
And why is that important?
Well, at least two or three things are super important. Number one, in forestry, people think about productivity, just like in farming. Mm-hmm. If you're going to plant your corn, you want to know how many bushels you're going to get per acre and so on. In forest, likewise. If you're going to invest money and grow this for 40, 50, 100 years, you want to know what's coming out on the other end. And people have always known that if you plant, let's say you plant your red pine in Wisconsin or any other species, you just plant it because it's available. You may discover that you planted in the wrong place, and then you need to know why. So all this leads us to the biggest question of all. How much difference is there between one soil and another in a county or a part of the state and so forth? So that question has been around. And one way to get at it, of course, you can do a lot of research on soils themselves. But think about how complex that would be. You would have to sample thousands of actual samples,
yes,
analyze them in the lab, and then get the information out and so forth. This, of course, is being done. But nature is far too powerful for us. It's kind of way ahead of us all the time. We never get all the answers. So what I'm talking about here, what we have come upon is this. Since we have this native vegetation out there that comprises a forest, not just the trees, herbs, shrubs, the works, and they sort themselves out themselves in a certain way. So then when I travel around and I look left and right, up north and south, I see these different combinations. And some ecologists start asking, why don't we just ask the plants what's underneath? So basically, that is how the system came about. We sampled thousands of locations in the state. Simultaneously, we would take soil samples, so we would study the soil in detail and had a complete list of plants that grew there. And then, of course, we do some interesting analysis that people will not be interested in. That's what academicians do. But at the end, what comes out, and this what people will understand, we find out that we look closely like this, we will find as we travel around, we have communities, plant communities, that are repeatable. When I see jack pine, red pine mixture forest, I look on the ground, I will always see blueberries and wintergreen, and I can list a whole bunch of other things. So in a nutshell, what this does, it identifies to us a category, let's say a groups of plant associations that actually mean something far more than the fact that these plants grow together over there, those other plants grow together. They are telling us, I put this on a kind of a gradient from very poor soils, and mm-hmm. by poor I mean poor water retention, poor nutrient, and then I move up the scale, a little better, something in the middle, then all the way up to excellent. I think it's good for all of us to kind of visualize nature to really be like that. And these plants are telling us, we now have a system that with a little examination in any spot that you want to classify, it will tell you where on this gradient we reside with that particular stand. Now, of course, to do that, you got to use the manual that I'm talking about.
And the manual is, you've got a guide to forest communities and habitat types of northern Wisconsin.
Yes, this is the major piece. For Wisconsin, we have two such guides. The southern one is separate. Mm-hmm. We kind of divide a state into, for obvious reasons, climatic reasons and others. Yeah. So this one is for northern Wisconsin, but it covers, a great number of counties, let's say. And that is divided then into regions that are based, that kind of isolate some geologic substrate that we have and some mm-hmm. climatic gradients that we understand. So for the whole state, we recognize 11 regions. The northern part has 5 and the southern part 6. So with that in mind, we can go into that particular area and we can classify forests based on, by habitat type, we mean the substrate, really the quality of substrate, as I mentioned a little earlier. And there's in the guide, there are nice keys for you to accomplish that. Now, what you have to know, of course, is this was designed for professionals who obviously study plants. You have to know a lot of plants. Any interested person can learn them. But you will have to know, I would say, you have to be prepared to know somewhere around 100 forest plants. And then you can tackle this and it will lead you all over the place, giving you guidelines in order to management.
Yeah, maybe you can talk more about the details of how it's used once they have this information.
Yep, of course. It is intended to be a tool. I always say that this is not just an academic exercise, although it's very interesting, of course, from in its own way. But we knew all along that there's real demand for this. People really want to know, what kind of a site type am I dealing with? What can I do with it? So when you have this thing, you walk into a forest, and I simply crisscross an acre or two, whatever mm-hmm. amount of land you have. You're crisscrossing. You have a checklist. You write down the names, the herbs you know. There are many shrubs, trees. Well, if you can do all that, then you can sit on a stump, whip out that little book that I'm talking about, and it will have a key. It's a very simple key to these types, and it will ask you a question like this. Do you have two or more of these? And they're listed in there. And you will say yes or no. If yes, I'll go on to ask another question. Do you have this group? I'm going to give you a list. Is this group better represented or the one on the left better represented? Hmm. So it's kind of a yes or no. In about 3 steps, it spits it out and it says, you are on type. Now, the type names are mouthfuls, I have to admit. They're based on the scientific names of plants that characterizes. We don't need to get into that right here. But the idea is that it will bring you down. Let's say in any given county, you will land on anywhere from 6 to 8 such groups, such types. And then you will be led to a chapter that deals with each one of them in detail. And once you get into that, I can guarantee you, you're going to get very excited because more questions will come up, many answers will be there, and people like to use it.
Our guest today, John Kotar, retired forest ecologist from the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at UW-Madison. As you were talking about the classification system, I was thinking about what the state looked like a long time ago, mm-hmm. with the four, and I'm thinking, well, the soil types probably didn't change that much from one area to another, but what did, you know, all years and years back, what did our forests look like?
This is actually one of the best questions to start with anywhere, and we do ask it very often, and we should, because what we are thinking, a professional ecologist forester really is thinking of a natural forest. And what I mean by a natural forest is one that developed there without the help of man, yeah. or I should say sometimes indirectly, because humans mm-hmm. have been on this continent for many thousands of years. They do have an impact through fire and such things. But anyway, the forests differed then. And to describe them very briefly like this, in the northern half of the state, again, let's view it that way, you would have on a sandy, droughty soils, there were mixtures of pines. We mm-hmm. have just three species of pine in Wisconsin, jack pine, red pine, and white pine, of course. So any mixtures of those, but which mixture, again, mattered what was under them. Each of these have their own requirements for growth, development, competition. Mm-hmm. So they will sort themselves out according to what the soils provide. But then in other places where the soil gets a little better, more moisture and nutrients, all of a sudden you have an addition of what we consider more demanding soil, nutrient-demanding species. And typically these would be the broadleaf species, as we say, deciduous, anything obviously from aspen up to sugar maple. We all know we love mm-hmm. sugar maple for many reasons. Sugar maple, by the way, is sort of at the top of the scale in terms of what it requires for optimal growth in the state, as opposed to, let's say, pines. Pines are satisfied with very little water and very few nutrients. They keep the nutrients in the needles. They don't drop them every year like maples do.
Yeah.
So those are the differences that are very important. So anyway, someone who would have traveled in this country 200 whatever years ago before the European settlement would have encountered all of these, depending, of course, on where you were traveling. And then what we have to bring into the picture right away is the disturbance. Forests are not just there forever. Yeah. They arise from something. They develop. They change in composition, structure. Other species come to join, so to speak. And then you have disturbances. You have a particular disease that wipes out one species but not the other. A big fire, of course, would be a complete wipeout of the stand. You start over again. So when things are rebounding, obviously the forests look different for the time. So the early travelers were able to describe just about every kind of forest that we see today, except, of course, that some were far more prominent. People know that Wisconsin had pine, and it did, but it was not covered with pine from border to border, so to speak. White pine was a primary species on most soils in one combination or another, and it really was definitely the very first economic force in Wisconsin. It was valuable for everything. It's got excellent lumber. And one more thing why it's so important. This one people never guess. I ask people all the time when we talk about this. What else? What is it about white pine that made it to be such a demand? Why not maple or oak? Nobody comes up with an answer. And you know what it is? Pine floats in the water, and oaks and maples
they sink.
So imagine you're in the days of no roads of any kind. Water was transportation. So these things, pines were logged, driven by horses, oxen, whatever, to the edges of waterways, floated down. All our rivers have been used for floating logs. And, of course, they wind up in the bigger rivers, Wisconsin, Chippewa, Mississippi.
Yeah.
And that's where the sawmills begin. And Wisconsin probably would not be here today as an economic sort of substantial power today in modern times if it weren't for the early start that put us on a map. Think about cities that were developed or built outside in the prairie states and every outside of the forest biome, as we call it. all of the lumber had to come from Wisconsin, Michigan, Minnesota, and such places. So we were it at the time.
John Kotar, our guest today, retired forest ecologist from the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at UW-Madison. Having fun with him talking about forests and of Wisconsin and how they're classified and why that's important. Want to talk about climate change with him, maybe talk a little bit more about fire as an example. I'm Larry Mueller. Dave Potratz, our engineer today, Jill Nadeau, our producer, and you are listening to the Ideas Network. Along about 11:45, we'll be taking a look at how to keep your trees healthy and safe with another guest. But right now, visiting with John Kotar about forests themselves and the classification of forests. John Kotar is a retired forest ecologist in the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology. And let's take a call. Ron in Norwalk, thank you for calling.
Yeah, hi, Larry, and hello to your guest. In the forest where I live, on my property specifically, I have a lot of invasive species. Well, you name it, I have it sort of thing. And I'm wondering, as far as ecological progression down the road, if left alone or if controlled, what's going to be the outcome down the road with these species that are coming into our forest? Will it eventually stabilize, or what does your guest think?
Yeah, good question, Ron. Thanks for calling.
Agreed. This is a very fine first call. Very much so. We obviously, when we talk about our forests right now up to this point, we are considering the native vegetation, all of the native vegetation. Well, and what is native vegetation? Of course, in Wisconsin, it is all of the plants that managed to get back to Wisconsin after the ice obliterated everything in the ice age. So we've gotten accustomed to, and we value, obviously, our natural vegetation. And lo and behold, if you hang around long enough and you examine your forests, your fields more often, you're going to start seeing certain plants that you didn't see before. And I remember, years ago when I was being trained in these areas, there was no talk about invasive, certainly not endangered species and things like that. But now we are more aware of these things, and it is a very important subject. I listen very carefully when people bring this up, and they ask a question, really. I mean, what can we do? First of all, if these additions, as we call them, in species are coming into the place, are they going to become part of the community? Will we accept them as part of the new natural community? Or is there something about them that we need to be concerned about, that we need to try to keep them out? And the caller here is talking about endangered species. There are always going to be endangered species. I mean, some species in their environments thrive well, and they have ample so-called elbow room ecologically, the way I see it.
Sure.
Other species are rather specific, and we often don't even know what that is that is required for them to exist in the association that we see. But we do get concerned when we start seeing losses of them. We often don't know for sure if these reductions or losses are temporary, so not because they're cycles of everything, or is something going on here that threatens the species as a whole. It is a difficult topic to deal with. People, including scientists, aren't sure, really, the importance of every one of these. All I can say, really, conclusively, all I can say that we are definitely aware, we're paying attention to these things. We keep studying the relationships of these species, and we will see what happens in the future.
And, you know, you take something like buckthorn.
Buckthorn is a thorn in everybody's you-know-where.
Yeah.
But an interesting plant. It's invasive, most of it. It's a European type. It grows nicely in shade and likes just about any kind of soil. And, yeah, people don't like it. It is hard to eradicate. And in some areas where it is getting in the way of whatever you desire your forest community really to support and sustain, you may have good reasons to try to reduce it. But I also hear from people who actually love it for a different reason. Buckthorn stays green pretty much into the winter, if not all of the winter. I remember in a talk not unlike this one when somebody was complaining, says, the most beautiful thing that he has on a hillside in the winter, he's got this greenery. It's all buckthorn. So who's going to argue about aesthetics here? But it, again, as most of these questions or issues, they're complex. They simply are complex.
Aaron in Peshtigo has something for us. Hi, Aaron. Thank you for calling.
Hey, Larry. I'm up here in Peshtigo, and you were talking about forest disturbance before, and we were at the epicenter of horrible fire about 160 years ago. But my farm, we're located in what's called the sugar bush, and so we have a lot of sugar maples and popples and white pine in the upland areas, but we have a lot of ash swamps in the lowland areas, white ash and black ash. And Southern Marinette County is just starting to be impacted by emerald ash borer. And so I'm curious what your guest thinks about what's the future for those, ash swamp areas. What trees are we going to find there in the future once the emerald ash borer has had its way with us?
Oh, terrific. Another good question, Aaron.
Well,
thanks.
You have very educated callers. We hear that comment often, but it's true. The caller is very much informed on this. It is a very, very important issue. It has been around not all that long, actually, but it is a very, very rapidly spreading species, this emerald ash borer. And yes, it's an interesting insect. It feeds only on ash. We have
Any
kind of ash, exactly. And on uplands where you have your maples and other hardwoods, ash is often a component, but it's a minor component. So here and there, there's one. All of these bugs find them anyway. But if you lose an ash tree in a combination like that, you may not notice the impact, or the result may not really be all that significant. On the other hand, if you go down into these swamps, in the so-called swamp, the wetlands, of those we have many as well. We have a habitat type classification for wetland forests. We haven't talked about that, but it's new, just came online. It's available on our website. But anyway, likewise, in the wet sites, we have the kind of a range of plant associations. And on the richer types, the richer wet ones, black ash is sort of king of the hill, or the swamp, let's put it this way.
Yeah.
This time. On uplands, it would be sugar maple. Down in the swamps, it is black ash. And it is threatened, no doubt about it. However, I have to say there are some promising things coming out of the biological controls. I think Glenn Stenros may be asked this later on. Ask him about that. He's into this kind of thing. There are all kinds of biological methods using certain parasitic wasps that attack the ash borer. They're being experimented with some really promising results. But there are also other techniques. The way your wetland forest would be managed to encourage some other plants, some other species that would replace the lost black ash and so forth. But in some cases, even right now, we see complete mortality of black ash. So for time being, that place, as far as being a tree community, is a goner. What would replace it then would be sedges and things of that sort, aquatic wetland vegetation. And of course, the question always then is raised, is this good? Is it bad? Or what do we make of it? People are always asking, what will replace the black ash swamps if black ash is gone completely? We don't have the answers yet. We are working on it. By we, I mean the scientific community and so forth. This will be going on. But it is also important to consider other forms of ecosystems that may arise in place where once black ash was the principal species.
It's going to be interesting. If we were around 100 years from now.
Oh, yeah.
I
often think
fun?
I would love to have a peek every century or so from wherever I am. Have a peek and see what is out there. It would be fascinating.
It would be. Aaron, thanks again. Mary in Ashland, let's give you a chance now. Hi, Mary.
Hi. I have a book from the Vaughan Library resale shop, the Book Nook, by Theodore Kuba called Wisconsin's Amazing Woods, Then and Now, with photographs. You can't imagine. So I wonder if John Kotar has, you know, a comment regarding whether, you know, the fragmented forests we have now can still be supplied with nutrients, enough nutrients by the mycorrhizome to you know, establish growth at the level of forest that the earth needs during this time of climate change. We're sort of on the cutting edge of, you know, sustainability or death, right?
Yeah, interesting as well. Very interesting. Because what we have at heart here is a natural forest. I mean, when we talk about forest, forestry trees, there's two ways, there's two sides that we're looking at it. Obviously, it's an economic base. That's one thing.
Mm-hmm.
We know how to get it. The entire agricultural system works in that direction. But what we sometimes forget is that forest is not a cornfield, soybean field, whatever. A forest, truly, is an incredibly complex, developed ecosystem that has evolved over, obviously, millions of years. And we need it. It is something that we humans really, really are based upon. So when I tackle questions like this, which brings us to the question of actual sustainability of the forest ecosystem themselves, then we need to address things like this. And by that, I mean, how do we maintain a forest ecosystem in any particular area so that it continue the processes that are in place?
Yeah.
They have to do with everything. Not only, obviously, we see things that we use directly, such as wood and other things of that sort, but there are many, many things. They're keeping our soils rich and productive. They are controlling and maintaining clean waters. I mean, there's no such thing as clean water unless you have a good vegetation base where the erosion is prevented and so forth. So anyway, I guess what I'm driving at here is that we need to build a stronger appreciation of what a natural forest is, not just a plantation that plants the things that can then be used. And I think a caller here is referring to sort of with climate change and so forth, the forest, how are they changing and what the future may have in store for them. I think, first of all, this is a very, very slow process. I think in terms of nutrient availability in the soil, there's not a big concern at this time. The nutrients are obviously in soil being produced, I should say, from the parent material through organic activity, soil chemistry, those sorts of things. I don't think it's that, but I think as the climate changes, the forest will also change, however subtly, and we will have to learn about these changes to kind of go along. And when we see that some aspects of our forest that we value are being lost or are in danger of being lost, we will find ways perhaps to mitigate the problem or the loss. But we are all basically really simply watching and struggling and guessing, predicting what future will be like when this climate shifts. We mustn't forget, though, obviously, that this is not the first time ever. Climate has been changing forever and ever and ever.
Yeah.
We have gotten accustomed to living, in terms of human lifespan, with a climate that's pretty much the same every year. We have the seasons. We pretty much have the normal this, normal temps, normal. All of this is going to shift. And as you say, Larry, 100 years from now, it'd be interesting to compare. So anyway, I don't think there's anything, how should I say, magic to be said at the moment about the issue. But simply to stay on top of it, be aware.
And the fragmented forests.
Fragmentation is another thing entirely. Of course, at one time, the forest was continuous, dispersed in places with prairies and such, where fire, historic fire, played a role. This is the reason all forests did not, the forests were not all old and mature when first Europeans came on the scene. We had all kinds of them. But at least there was a continuous forest. If you had in one area where, like Peshtigo, someone mentioned earlier, mm-hmm. one of the callers, we know just the most devastating fire. That changed the entire ecosystem over many thousands, really, of acres. That then recovered the natural way. Sometime later, 100 years later, you wouldn't even know that it happens. So we had a fragmented forest in a sense that there was a pattern or a quilt work of mixtures. We have then, of course, removed pretty much all of that and then replaced it with the species we choose. And also, our forests are spatially fragmented nowadays. Instead of thousands of acres, perhaps, of something, you're down to 40, 20, 5. And that matters. It matters more to other organisms. We haven't addressed anything else just yet.
Yeah.
And for those of you who might be listening, we are not forgetting all other organisms, not the animals, the mammals, the birds, the things. Everything is part of this forest that we're trying to sort of get our hands on. And changes that we introduce impact all of these. And, of course, climatic gradient shift slowly will affect all of this.
Yeah.
And personally, I look at that and I accept the dynamic nature of this change and staying on top of it, just as we did in the past and up till now. Stay on top, try to learn as much as we can, and understand our natural systems.
Thank you again, Mary, for your question. Bob in Land O'Lakes, it's your turn. Hi, Bob. Thanks for calling.
How you doing today? I just try to make a brief comment. I was very fortunate to begin my consulting career, forestry consulting career in northern Wisconsin when John was just publishing his first the first publications of this system, work he did in UP, but then now I think we're in our second version of the Northern Wisconsin, second edition. But I probably can speak for most field foresters that this is probably, this was the most important, almost revolutionary change in how we view forests. As foresters, because prior to the system, John's work, everything was based on maps and soils maps, and it was much more complicated. Today, we can go into the forest and just looking at ephemeral plants and other plants that kind of indicate what the habitat is, we can now interpret, it's a much more systems-based system, and we can interpret what the moment, basically, the habitat types indicate what the type of forest that can develop on that. Prior to this, we were all looking at cover type, which is the trees that exist. And now, with the habitat classification system, and John, maybe you could talk more about this.
Yeah.
How it relates to cereal stages and successional pathways that the forest moved through. So this opened up a whole range of options for private landowners and other landowners to how they would manage the forest. We no longer are just trying to regenerate the existing cover type.
Exactly. Excellent call. I really appreciate it. Obviously, one of the major components of this ecosystem or the site classification system is really a further interpretation and the dynamics. In other words, what do we expect on this particular type to occur down the road? Because nature is not stable. Nature is always doing something. And any forest really undergoes a successional trend. And Bob brings up this point very importantly. So, for example, when we talk about the trees that we all know, birch, maple, I see here, he's referring to dying birch and maple replacing it.
Somebody else,
Someone else did that. I think we're going to get to that already. But Bob here is alluding to succession. So in other words, you may have an aspen forest on your land. Your neighbor has aspen forest. You all have some aspen forest. And you get together and you kind of want to decide how you're going to manage your lands the same way in a sense. But you may have one in a super productive, rich land, and your neighbor over there on a land that is pretty lousy, but it still supports aspen. And the two of you, because you only looked at aspen, will not see the difference. So on a rich end, the demanding species, such as sugar maple, basswood ash, are already in place to get in there and replace this aspen forest. Aspen is extremely light-demanding species. Aspen can only get started in a completely open environment. It creates a forest. It dies of old age. And in the meantime, usually the longevity, 30, 40, 50 years on average, and other species that can endure some shade will get started underneath, and the next forest will look completely different. But if you go on a poorer side where sugar maple would kind of, you know, say, I'm not going there. In other words, not enough stuff there for sugar maple to thrive. So there, the aspen, it grows, and when it dies and breaks up a bit, it can resprout from its rhizomes and so forth. Aspen is reproduced primarily from the sprouting, the underground stems that you have. And it may go like this for a while until something else, like white pine seeds, get in there. White pine has enough shade tolerance to get established in a partial shade, and it will grow fast. And by the time it reaches the height of that aspen, it will pretty much say, goodbye, aspen, and keep on growing. And here's your white pine. And I need to say a couple of things about it for sure. White pine really is king of the forest in Wisconsin in all the ways that I can think of. First of all, it grows the biggest, the oldest, 200, 300, 400 years old ones, we find. It produces seed that germinates fine in a partial shade as well as out in the open. So it tends to dominate the side kind of indefinitely, not in a pure form. It will have other associated species like hemlock, which likes a lot of shade, and others. But white pine will be back on our landscape. And, in fact, it's coming back now. Foresters 50 years ago were very much concerned about white pine being lost for good in Wisconsin after the cutovers and fires and all that. They weren't patient enough, and they weren't observing that the seed sources that are still around have actually produced new growth just about everywhere. So, I mean, personally, I'm happy to see white pine coming back on the scene.
Well, you know what? Here we are out of time. Bob and Franklin, maybe we'll get to you when our next guest comes in. But, John, this has been a fascinating conversation. I want to thank you so much for being with us today. I hope we have a chance to do this again.
It's very enjoyable. I think we both enjoy talking to our listeners, people who are interested in this sort of thing.
Yeah.
It's been great. Enjoyed.
John Kotar, retired forest ecologist from the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at UW-Madison, and his guides, as we heard from Bob in Land O'Lakes, have been invaluable for not only professional foresters like Bob, but for you and for me in many ways, even if not directly, the two of us, indirectly, at the very, very least. Coming up, we're going to zero in a bit more on assessing risk to your trees with our next guest, who's actually a colleague of John's, Glenn Stanos, professor of tree and forest health in the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology. Our next guest here on the Ideas Network.